So thanks for everyone for coming. And the format is quite relaxed. It's really just in conversation. And then there'll be hopefully quite a large part of it will be questions from you guys.
Which I will avoid.
So the reason we screened Carlton just prior to the in conversation, as well as obviously the Ghost Chair that's playing here at the moment, is that what's come to light is that this film, Louis Ghost Chair, is forming part of a trilogy which began with Carlton.
Which began with Carlton, yeah.
And will the third film will be is imminent.
The third film, which is in pre-production, is going to be called You Are Feeling, or Feeling.
So it might be good to think about that in relation to the questions in terms of the possible similarities or differences between the way that you've treated ideas and objects in the different films.
Yes.
But initially, thinking about Carlton and Louis Ghost Chair, I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about the way that they're filmed in terms of the use of the framing of the camera, but also the idea of the gaze or the way of seeing, in that to think about those two films together, I often think firstly about the way that it's foregrounded about a way of seeing or a way of thinking about something before you even start to consider what the object is.
Yeah, that's a strategy I've tried to employ. So maybe I should talk maybe a little bit about Carlton. It's quite an old film for me now, and I basically it came from noticing, it came from a lot of different points, but it mobilised around. My thinking was mobilised around this idea of noticing in the built environment how, just like as you're walking through the street and stuff, I live in London, how certain kind of buildings were beginning to look a little bit old and tatty, how postmodern buildings were beginning to sort of show signs of wear, that they weren't looking like this ideological high point anymore. They looked old, and I noticed them from beginning, from them looking new to them, to them looking old. So I was kind of trying to sort of figure that out. I was also trying to think a bit about Solstice as well. And if you ever look online at Solstice or Carlton, which is the object, or if you ever look at any images, you'll always look at this one, you'll always find this one image of Carlton against this infinity curve backdrop, which is lit in this very particular way. And this just becomes almost becomes programmatic about how you read the object. You always see this object against this background every time. And so what that film, I tried to do in a really crude way, and obviously not as technically efficient as that film, but what I tried to do in a really crude way was try and reproduce that image in some way. So it just came from this desire to enter that image, to sort of go through the surface of that photograph or that JPEG or whatever format it was in, and into the space of the photograph in some way. So I became really interested in this idea of the object and the backdrop, which I think is picked up in that film, where the backdrop is under. What did you say? You said it was active backdrop or something. Is that right?
I was thinking about the infinity curve, especially in the three different works that are in this exhibition.
Yeah.
And how they relate to a way. I was thinking about the way that they allow you to be both submerged and distanced from the object at the same time, almost simultaneously.
Yeah.
And it's we're trained to sort of almost to try not to see it, but it becomes this sort of.
Well, once you see it, you can't not see it.
Theatrical or active space beyond the lens.
Yes. 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 Well, I mean, theatre is a, you know, it wasn't, I mean, I was thinking of it in terms of the mise-en-scene, you know, as a thing that participated in the drama of that was I was trying to unfold with the objects and the narratives. And the way the narratives were written and delivered. So, you know, it was an active part in the whole setup, you know.
And the way that the camera sort of drifts through that space in both the films.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a very basic observation, but it's one that I can never quite understand, is this. When you point a camera at something, it does this really curious thing. It records what it's in front of you, but it also, at the same time, transforms that thing. It changes that thing. It's just a mechanic. It's just a device for recording something, but it's also an interpretive device as well. And it's just happening both at the same time. It can't not be. It always is. So, you know. And so, you know, when you do things like tracking shots and static shots and shots that are held for slightly too long and all those things, it, again, it's a way of pointing out that there's a camera involved and it's not an invisible eye, you know. It's actually constructed.
And in terms of that sort of sense of things being held slightly too long or...
Maybe the motivation behind that is a psychological one, fear of losing the shot. So I'm sort of trying to hold it a bit too long to sort of concentrate the vision and concentrate the way you look at it. It's it's something that I've done probably a bit too much. But they're not really long shots, they're just a little bit too long.
But it's a fetishistic gaze in terms of, you know, you say opening it up to the idea that it's a constructed shot. I mean, if you watch lots of youth TV like I do, you can see that
never heard of it.
You get all lots of, you know, really short changes. Mm, really, and that also draws your attention to the construction of the piece, because it's a different type of, it's anti-fetishistic, I suppose.
Which one? The
youth TV.
The youth TV.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it's anti-fetishistic, but it's a different kind of...
It creates a particular kind of emotional energy and currency around what's being, the camera's being pointed at, which creates another kind of fetish, maybe, I'd argue.
Mm.
You know, it creates a certain kind of... because you can't quite see what you're looking at, it creates a kind of... I want more of it, you know. So in a way, they both create fetish.
Yeah.
It's just different ways of doing it, maybe.
Just moving away from a sort of idea of naturalised viewing time.
Yes. I mean, that's unnaturalised, and that's unnaturalised as well. It's entirely constructed.
Both examples are major fragments as well, aren't they? So you're putting together a camera frame, but a frame that is picking out a fragment, whether it's in time or in space. So those long shots are extended in one way but contracted in another, which creates an interesting tension, I think, especially when you're moving across the and and that I'm very interested in the movement, because it looks like you've programmed, I don't know if with Carlton, whether you've programmed one of the pans is quite quick, almost too quick for an operator to do manually. So then that's really interesting. The intervention of a moving camera often approximates a person walking around an object.
Yeah.
But in this case, that sort of projected sense of subjectivity gets transformed back into a mechanical one.
Yes.
Because it's a very direct kind
of because of the speed of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's probably something to be exploited more, actually.
And there is a total lack of naturalised viewing anyway, and I suppose maybe that's what's interesting is that, you know, I suppose a lot of normal, I don't know, I'm just trying to think of an example,
of anything normal.
Anything normal.
You know, if you're seeing something with a camera, you start playing with the day and
time
and how you see.
I think there's this idea of, I think there's this idea of setting something aside in some way to look at it. In Carlton, I say, when is it ever useful to look at an object in isolation? Is it to see it more clearly or to experience the flow of events? Or I can't remember exactly, but it's like this idea of getting something and setting it aside, which you do when the museum takes a photograph of an object, is to see it from, you know, it's like it's useful. But it's really perverse as well, because this idea of, you know, if you're making a film of a guy getting going to the fridge and getting the milk out of the fridge, you know, you don't even see him doing it. it's rendered transparent because of the speed of the manoeuvre and everything. But the way I do it, fridge for 10 minutes, milk bottle for 10 minutes.
Then I suppose that sort of the idea of taking something out of its context in order to look at it in a different way or to form new connections between things. When moving from Carlton, which is a single object, to Louis Vuitton's chair, which is
objects in relation
to each other, and then the ideas for.
Well, the third film, Earth Feeling, is hopefully. I'm always kind of. Lauren Sweeney always says that art is the relationship of human beings to objects in relationship to other human beings, and it's like it's a bit of a sort of mantra of his. It's a bit of a kind of crude working definition of what art is in one way, but in another way, it's a really nice, clear way of thinking about what it is that, in some way, we're all. Well, not all of us trying to, but I'm trying to do, you know. And I think that, Carlton's looking at the single thing. Louis Gosgier is looking at a bunch of things in relation and also foregrounding the background in some way. And the third film is I want to use actors for the first time. And I want a different way of telling or constructing an object or constructing a thing. So, whereas these work in the realm of the faux lecture or, you know, pedagogical film or something like that, the third film I want to move more in towards story to make more of a story and to be more for it to be more immersive. Not that these aren't necessarily immersive, but, you know, for you to understand human beings a bit more.
I mean, something that's interesting in relation to
that. It's rubbish, that last thing. You know what I mean.
It's the voiceover.
Yeah. It's the same person
in both these films.
Yeah.
And do you feel that the way that she's describing things differs, you know, is it a trajectory?
Well, yeah, I mean, I found this actress initially on her showreel, she did the Herbal Essences advert. and she just had this fantastic ability to sound in on her show. I found out in the end she didn't do the Herbal Essences advert. It was just she. It was just she'd got the script and used. You know, but she had this amazing ability to be different things, from being a little bit cheeky to a little bit formal to a bit RP, received pronunciation to a bit. She kind of shifted identities, you know, almost, and she's been able to do it. I mean, I'm so familiar with the work, I know it inside out, unlike all you lot, but it's like she can almost do it between the beginning of a sentence and the end of a sentence, how she shifts, you know. So she was really good. And when I wrote the script for this, I initially wasn't going to use her. I was going to, I actually recorded it with a 14-year-old girl, because I wanted, there's a phenomenon known as tweenagers, I think they're called.
I think I'm one.
And it's a very particular demographic that kind of, they're, you know, super smart kids, basically, but they're still kids, you know. And they're, you know, they're usually girls, they're usually a bit more fashionable than the rest of the, you know, but, you know, that it's like a real particular phenomena, and I just wanted this kind of voice to try and own this kind of language in some way, but it didn't work out. I didn't like it. She was good, but she was not brilliant, and there was a weird little bit of dissonance. I wanted a bit of cognitive dissonance, if that's the phrase. I wanted a bit of that. But it wasn't, I don't know, I felt a bit funny about the ownership. It felt like I was trying to push words through. And so when you get a professional voiceover actress, she, even though they weren't her words, she just owned them much more readily, you know. And that was really exciting to, so that's when I got her back to sort of work with her again. And I'm going to use her, I think, for the third.
I was just about to ask that in terms of...
I don't know how, though. Yeah?
Yeah, I suppose it also... I mean, it's touched on a little bit in the text that's written for this show by Sarah Smith, but
yeah.
About the use of a female voiceover, specifically
yeah.
when
yeah.
you're, you know, you're authoring the work and you're
yeah.
writing the script, and
well,
how that, you know, how you came to that decision.
Initially, I wanted to use a 14-year-old girl because... I wanted to find someone who was other than me, and I may be many things. One of the big influences, in a way, was John Berger's Ways of Seeing, which I used as material in and of itself. I think I see the TV program as being an artwork, really. John Berger, in the program, if anyone's ever seen it, is the late modernist artist par excellence. You know, look into my eyes, not around the eyes. You know, he stares at the camera like this. He's totally charismatic, handsome, and sort of like articulate. And he's convincing you, he's leading you on like the Pied Piper in some way. And you just watch that thing and you just think, he's great, you know. But I didn't want that. I didn't want, you know, this fantastic sort of, you know, figure sort of with a cape and, you know, doing, as I wrote to you, you know, Walter Benjamin Light, you know, for public broadcast, you know, it's like, he's really good at it, but I didn't want that. I wanted something else, and I wanted to find someone. I'm very interested in the language of the high street, hence that, you know, you can see it from the street. I wanted it to sort of have something of the. And this woman that I chose, you know, she does adverts and things like that. She's really good. So she's got this. She's got this kind of, there's an intimacy with her, you know. It's a voice that almost you don't hear, almost, you know. Does that make sense? There's an intimacy with
It's very smooth, I think.
Yes.
But my experience of it, anyway, is that it's kind of quite lulling. So whenever there's a jump, you sort of, you know, in some way she smooths out the sort of scatological elements.
She smooths out the problems.
But at the same time, heightens them, strangely.
Yeah. No, I just think she's fantastic. You know, and she's really good to work with as well. I don't know whether anyone's ever worked with a professional voiceover actress, but when I first worked with her, it was like I'd worked with people that weren't professional people before, but we went to this tiny little studio about the size of the bathroom in there in Soho, and she came in and we were there for an hour, and it was so what I imagine like Eric Clapton when he comes and does a session for Elton John or something. He comes in and plays the guitar and he's out about 11:30, you know, he's done it, you know, and he's just perfect, you know, not very good examples of people there, but you know, it's like,
so there might be a guitarist on
there. Yeah, yes, big, yes, yeah, it's my difficult third album. It's all going to consist of solos, guitar solos, yeah. No, but what I mean is that she just delivers.
Mm.
And I wanted that. I wanted somebody who could just come along and deliver a text and kind of like... It's just really interesting to use someone who couldn't own the sentence to someone that couldn't, like, from the beginning of the sentence to the end of the sentence, she owned it all, you know,
mm.
and put stuff in it as well.
Because it sounds like if it was only an hour, you didn't have time to really be directing her very closely in terms of her reading.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's like I'd spoken to her before on the first one. It was a bit over an hour, and we did more as well. But in a way, you know, sometimes you don't want to over-rehearse things because you just kill them, you know. And I told her what to do, and she did it. And she said, "Oh, maybe I could do it like this." And she did it like that, and it was better. And you know, that was, as I say, sometimes it's important not to, especially when you know you've worked on other bits of the work, other parts of the work, really. For ages, to sort of to create a better overall texture in the work, if other bits are a bit more done on the fly, then you know it's better. It's, you know.
How do you think the gestural quality of her voice, in terms of gesture and the film and the discussion of it, work together?
I personally like it. I mean. Because initially, many moons ago when I made that, Carlton, I was going to just write a piece of music for it. I was going to get all, it's like vintage synths and things, and you know, write a piece of music like John Carpenter from 1982 or something, from when that was made, just to sort of, but then I realised I wasn't doing anything, that was just doubling, and it needed to be some, you say gesture, or there needed to be some disruption or something. So that's why I, in the end, wrote the script, you know, not a natural writer. But so I wrote something which was a bit weird, and then I got her to do her thing on top of it. And it,
mm-hmm.
So it just livens up the whole process. I don't know how that's perceived, but just that in terms of making something. It was useful.
I think that you're beginning to talk about, in a way, about the ideas of the kinds of knowledge that you're talking about within the script,
yeah,
as well,
yeah.
And how they kind of flow between sort of something you already know, something you're learning, something that you're not quite sure of, and something that you're very sure of, that at least that's how I experience it.
That's interesting.
And then, and thinking about the way that, you know, you could perceive a documentary format as quite non-discursive.
Yeah.
And how you've been talking about the space that the object sits in as an active or a discursive space.
Yeah.
And how you negotiate or between those two things.
What kind of like discursive knowledge and non-discursive knowledge?
And how you can rupture those.
Yeah, I mean it's one is hopefully trying to create some form of dialectic, you know, where one type of knowledge disrupts another type of knowledge, you know, or one type of representation disrupts another type of representation. So it's a question of how successfully that's achieved is not for me to say, but you know, that's definitely an ambition.
Well, something that struck me especially in Louis Gosetier is the way that you sort of quote the object of Judd, but also quote, I think
I do quote him in it, yeah, one thing after another
as well,
yeah.
And how, you know, Judd seems like quite a sort of pivotal figure in a way. In terms of practice in general, and how his dialogue is, you know, his writing could be seen to be quite didactic.
Didactic. For me, Judd's a really weird patriarchal figure that I keep going back to disagree with. You know, he's really useful. He's a really useful figure to think about because he's so didactic and he's so prescriptive. You know, have you ever read any of his reviews? You know, this is good, this one is bad. You know, that's it, more or less, you know. And it's quite thrilling in a way. His prose style is quite ugly, but it's quite thrilling to sort of read something where somebody is so judgmental and unafraid of his judgments. But it probably leads to a form of madness, which made him decide that he couldn't live in New York any longer and move to the desert or something, you know. So in a way, that kind of weird patrician language and you know, the very Americanness of Judd as well interests me, and that version of Manifest Destiny that he has tried to embody in his practice, you know. It's quite John Wayne, isn't it, really? The whole endeavour, you know.
Well, that's kind of it looks a little bit like how you've used him in the film, that he comes in at a point as a sort of mediator, in a way, between... Well, that's what I got.
That's interesting.
Wrong.
That's,
but,
yeah, maybe, yeah. Oh, I'm going to use that.
But he does, because we've got the sort of the wooden chair and then the ghost chair, and
yeah.
It seemed to me that he was the point where... In between,
actually. Well, I think it's interesting. I think he had to come in at that point, in a way, you know, to sort of act, you know, to sort of tell you a certain bit, to sort of hang all the other stuff on. And it's kind of quite, you know, and I sort of deliberately do that thing, you know. 1963 is 1963. A camera pointed at something is a camera pointed at something. Wood is wood, you know. I do that to sort of reinforce his language and his... you know, like when we made... I made the piece with a friend of mine, because I'm... Because... I can't knock a nail in, basically. Well, I can, but I forgot. How to, you just forget stuff. How you forget
what
that.
What did you have to knock a nail into?
To make the Donald Judd.
Well, it wasn't real.
No. No. No.
I wonder if you got permission.
Yes. No, I didn't get permission. There's no reason for you to know any of my work, but I've got a sort of bit of a back story of appropriation where I've made other art objects and other artists' work.
But you didn't remake the ghost chairs?
No, we hired those.
Yeah.
And we hired the
carpenter.
Carlton. Yeah. But the you know that Judd is a very valuable object in Washington or somewhere like that, you know, and wouldn't be moved. You know, you can't move it because it's. But he was at a stage. I did a lot of research. He'd met him and his father apparently made that. It was that was just before he went into proper production mode. And I remember seeing it at Tate during the Judd retrospective. It's quite badly made. Or quite excitingly badly made in a way, you know. And
I
when we made
that.
It.
Yeah.
Sorry?
I could do that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Was your own batter?
Yeah. Well, you know what? Let's wait for. Because it's now 50 years old. That is still an amazingly weird, radical object. This just is 62 is made. It's 63, I think it was. And it's nearly 50 years old, you know. And and it's still an ugly, weird thing that sits in the room in a quite aggressive way. You know, it doesn't hold the room nicely, you know. Or it really, you know, and it's, I find that still quite, and it still divides, people still don't dislike it and stuff. And I find that kind of interesting, something which is one way deeply conservative, you know. There's in the States there's a bumper sticker that says what would Jesus do? WW whatever it is, and apparently in Marfa there was a bunch of stickers that went up that what would Donald Judd do? Because he was taking over the whole town. So the mantra that we had when we were making the object was what would Donald Judd do? And we basically method acted Donald Judd. We both got double denim on them. Our beards nice and bushy. we moved to the desert for a bit, got quite angry. But we basically tried to work out how we would make it, you know, from it's like an interesting bit of forensic work, you know, because it's nails and glue, mm-hmm. And it's not, we couldn't quite get Douglas fir, and then we found out you could get it, but so in a way it's all a bit, so in a way, to answer your question, it might be as well made as, mm-hmm. but the difference is 50 years, mm-hmm. you know, that the Judd's knocked around, and this is, that's sort of like box fresh, you know, ours. No pun there. It's new, so it maybe the you know, like whenever you see a brand new building, I remember this at Nottingham Contemporary, when I went to see Nottingham Contemporary, the building, it felt a bit like it needed about 5 or 6 years before it got softened off. Everything just looked a bit like, you know, when you wear a brand new pair of shoes and you have to get people to stamp on them to sort of wear them in a bit. You know, it's like it felt a bit like that, the Judd. It felt a little bit too new. Its materiality was a little bit too lively. And it just had to be softened down a bit. So maybe in 50 years' time, if it's still around.
Did you not have to try and age it, distress it?
Well, we discussed that. And I decided against it.
It looks distressed. Mm.
Well, no, it's because it's just the materials, you know. It's like it's plywood with paint just directly onto it, and nails. It's really, really simple. That's part of its radicality in a way. It's actually quite a simple thing. It's very, very dumb and a bit rough and ready.
But then I suppose the voiceover. When you're looking at it and listening to that, then you go, well, I thought it was the original thing.
Yeah.
I didn't ever think, oh, he must have made that.
I mean, like it lends it credibility or something.
Yeah, well, you just stop questioning, don't you?
Yeah.
That's the authority of the camera.
Herbal essences.
Herbal essences.
It's like the pedagogical format of it as well, isn't it? That
yeah.
That you... Your expectation of what knowledge you'll receive through that, you know, whether it's
That one is original.
So I think it's the sequence to the plastic ones, and they're clearly.
Yeah.
Why did you, the Fleet Star chairs, did you have to hire them because they're a limited edition and they're particularly expensive to buy?
No, but. I'm got that wrong. Actually, we bought them.
Right.
We hired Carlton,
okay.
Or I hired Carlton, and this was done with a production company, Film and Video Umbrella, and they bought them,
mm-hmm.
and then they sold them at cost to people who, you know, wanted them, and they all sold.
But they're not expensive, are they? They're only like 80 quid or
something. Well, about 120, I think, now.
That's why I wonder about the hiring.
It's quite cheap, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, they really are everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
they're extremely comfortable.
They're surprisingly comfortable. I don't particularly like them.
No.
But they're surprisingly... I like them because I was particularly... When I first came up to see you, put me up at a hotel somewhere, and just around the corner from where I was staying, there was a hairdresser's, and they were in the hairdresser's. And then I showed Carlton at Common Guild recently, and they put me in a hotel, and there was one in there as well. Actually, the sister, there's a one without the arms. Yeah, I know, it's just, they're just...
I saw you're a writer now.
It's on my right. It's be the gnomes next. Yeah, no, they are everywhere. There's a ubiquity to them, which was what sort of, you know, it's just this, it's, I mean, it is literally a ghost of something, you know, it's so basic, you know, but they're built into the world, it's this thing, you know, and... So yeah, that was kind of the one of the where I, you know, it wasn't necessarily because I'm a big fan of Philippe Starck.
Is there any kind of Marxist reference in that? That whole Marx is a ghosts and phantoms way they kind of appear in that.
Yeah,
but also the way, like, because I mean the way in which you kind of treat, like, you've made two films about objects, but they're kind of more about processes in terms of, like, the utility of the objects and their kind of value or meaning, or, like, there's a great tension between that. I mean, is the, like, the ghost thing, is that, I mean, is there anything in that?
I did think of Louis Ghostchair as being dialectical materialism for 14-year-olds. That was one of my little mantras. I keep saying the word mantra today, sorry, it's the third use of mantra. Do you know that bit in... I've actually not read the essay, but I know there's that little quote at the beginning about commodity fascism by Marx, where he talks about the dancing chair.
Mm.
Sorry, the dancing
table.
That was kind of part of my thinking.
What's really interesting is that there's a reference there also to the Ouija board, isn't there? So the idea that the table is a the means of channeling other generations.
Yes. Yes. That essay, there's a little quote at the beginning of that essay where it talks about. Basically says something along the lines, once you begin to think about a table, it sort of jumps out of itself, and you begin to realise its material and social relations, and it becomes more than a table, and it becomes more terrifying than anything you can imagine, you know, but it's there in front of you, you know, and once you begin to pick apart the material and social relations of it. So, it's very, you know, coming from, you know, it's as I say, I wanted it to be, you know, initially I wanted to make a film for children,
mm-hmm.
And to talk about an idea, certain sets of ideas, which comes from this idea of, I guess, maybe, you know, ways of seeing, you know, public broadcasting as well. And that's why I used a 14-year-old girl, I think, you know, partly. So I wanted to talk about some complex historical ideas, like you were mentioning, but to sort of do them in a way which is a bit more so kids. that still holds as an idea that might be taken forward, you know.
It's interesting in relation to the fact that something that I would have thought about when I was watching the Ghost Chair was about the fact that both of those sets of chairs kind of materialised at a point of growth of the middle classes and the kind of dynamics of the sitting room and those kinds of things. And that in relation to, specifically in relation to Bath and Edinburgh, where, you know, Holborn was a partner in the production of...
Yeah, it started off at the Holborn Museum in the city of Bath, and, yeah.
And something that attracted me to it having particular resonance here as well. In terms of those sort of potential of sort of unpicking.
Well, I got asked, when I got the commission, you know, and I went to Bath, and I didn't particularly like the place, but I thought it was like there was this, and I wasn't interested necessarily in anything about the city, you know, but I was just interested in the material and economic conditions by how a city like that might come about. It was the birth of the middle classes, you know. I never really thought much about the middle classes, you know, as a discrete entity in that way, you know. It was like, and you know, the middle classes are the agents of social change and this, and, you know, and they were then, and it's like, I just thought it might be the kind of dynamics of the living room in that way, which I'd sort of tried to. I'm actually doing this show at Camden Arts Centre in September, which is a. It's also going to be called Ur Feeling, and it's going to be I'm going to make the exhibition as a kind of trailer for the film, but it's going to be an exhibition of objects, and I'm going to borrow certain objects, and I found myself choosing a lot of furniture objects, and I found plotting it out the other day, I thought, I'm just making a front room, you know. Just sort of like, you know, it's almost like, where am I going to put the cushions, you know? And I mean, I don't live like that particularly, but it's just really interesting that I ended up. So this kind of social dynamic of, you know, and once you start reading about the madness of, you know, that kind of upper middle, late 17th century domestic life and. The little tables that women were allowed, but they were only like this big, and you have to fold everything out, and all those kinds of, and how you relate to, how you relate to the world through proximity of stuff in this way.
That's what's interesting about the ghost chairs, though, because they're aspirational middle class, and actually,
yeah.
The way you see them sold to you is you can have a tiny new build house, flat. And these are sort of desirable objects, but they won't actually take up any real space because they're transparent. And it still gives you the idea that there's the illusion of space in your home.
Yeah.
Because space itself is the sort of thing you want to represent to whoever's coming along to your dinner party. So transparent furniture and glass furniture. I don't know. I mean, I don't know when we started making it. It was like the 70s, actually. I've got a 70s glass table, but... But it seems like it is all.
Yeah, I did this, one of these actually, with in Sheffield the other week. Because it's part of this exhibition called British Modern Remade, which was an exhibition in the flats in Sheffield. What are they called? The is it Park Hill?
Yeah, I think that's right.
The Brutalist building, which has been taken over by Urban Splash.
Yeah.
Do you know Urban Splash? Just the name. Urban Splash alone tells you all you need to know. And basically, it's quite fascinating actually what the. And I actually showed Carlton in a talk. I didn't show any, but there was in the show flat, somebody curated an exhibition from the Arts Council collection. So it's quite nice, you know, Kenneth Armitage and up to Keith. Who's the guy? Keith. It doesn't matter. It's a listed building, Park Hill, so they couldn't change the concrete structure, but you could. Everything else inside was changed. So it was like there was this sort of framework which they put in these new, you know, but everything seemed really impoverished. But it was, you know, nice, lots of light coming in and space. You felt space was really trying to be maximised. Because it's all being privatised as well, you know. The space was really trying to be maximised, but it was still. It felt the material build felt impoverished. Just felt.
Well, it's like that with you know, you were talking about the infinity curve, and when you were talking about it, I was thinking, I don't actually know what that is, but I'm guessing
it's just
that photographic.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
It's like it's also used in pop videos.
Yeah.
And things like that.
And then family photos.
Family photos.
But you get.
And these are all these are all museum photographs. So.
You get infinity pools, so your kind of aspirational holiday. You see a photograph, and everywhere's got infinity pools.
Yes.
It's just like the
yes.
thing that you're like, oh yeah, I'm going to get an apartment in infinity pools. It looks like I'm in the sea by myself.
Yeah.
I've
never been
in
one of those.
Swim on the edge of a cliff.
Yes,
yeah.
But it is, it's sort of horizonless.
Yeah.
And space is the thing.
Yeah, it's trying to insinuate some form of freedom through leisure or something, isn't it?
Mm.
Basically, yeah.
Well, that you can afford to be away from everyone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, because
there's never a whole boundary in that.
Boundary
there's a sort of seamlessness with the
yeah.
landscape. Which
and so is your future.
Yeah. Do you remember that advert? I think it was for Barclays Bank. It's a brilliant advert. It's so disgusting. And it was about sending your child off to university. But before you had a gap year before you went. And it was about, and the guy was talking about, you may go off and meet older, wiser people. And that phrase, when you're going to meet older, wiser people, it's about selling you this idea of, but the bank's doing it, you know, selling you this idea of some form of spiritual growth, you know, which is kind of locks into all these ideas of recuperation, I guess.
It also maybe plugs in slightly to the ideas of the ethnographic objects that you've.
Yeah.
You chose from the
yeah.
National Museum's collection.
Nicely done.
That's an infinity segue.
So, I wondered if we could talk a wee bit about that
yeah.
work as well,
yeah.
because it feels quite specific in
yeah.
relation to the other works.
Yeah.
And it also, in a way, touches very much on the idea of an archive, of a in the same way as, you know, you might. I noticed this was the Louis Ghost Chair was shot on digital.
Yeah.
And Carlton wasn't.
16, transferred.
So I'm interested in both the idea of the sort of digital archive of filming and editing in that format, and also the relationship between the objects that are in the photograph, which are in an archive, and the actual photographs themselves, which form part of another archive. I wondered if...
Well, Well, I'm becoming increasingly interested, I think, in digitization of all kinds, I guess. That sounds like a stupid sentence, didn't it? I'm just trying to work my way out around and think about that.
Well, I suppose in relation as well to the objects, because for a time we thought we might show those objects.
We were going to have actual objects,
And then for a series of things changed.
Yeah, it wasn't possible. But in a way that's, you know, fine and sort of fitted in, you know that it's like there's this ongoing thing between the object and its representation and what I do. So in a way it was a different piece of work it ended up being, but it's, you know.
In a way I think it brings it more into focus.
Yeah.
The idea of a digital representation of an object which is in a, again, without needing to ask, it is obviously in a white infinity curve because that's how they take all their photographs.
That's how they did them, yeah.
And that's how they take, you know, that's how objects are archived as images. Well,
in that
definitely
way.
In that organisation.
Yeah, definitely there, yeah.
So are they the museum's photographs then?
They are objects from the museum's archive and they're taken by the museum photographer.
Yeah.
But I chose the objects.
So
but the photographs pre-existed or did they then take the photographs for you?
They took the photographs for me.
So they didn't have them photographed in an
They had some of them.
They had some of them.
But I liked others as well, and so they took a whole bunch?
batch of a bunch.
To give a... They retook some, just to give a consistency of form.
And will they use them now?
I can use them and they can use them.
Oh, that's good.
So it's that sort of, in a way, I was interested in relation to a quote of Sherry Levine's that I know that you've used in your past as well,
yes.
In terms of that, the flow between past and present, your history and mine. In a way, how an archive, especially a digital archive, maybe could be a...
Yeah, yeah.
Portal.
A portal, yeah, yeah. Threshold. You know, there's something abyssal about archives. You know, they're like a big thing to fall into. And they're really sort of both compelling because of the abysmal nature of... Would that be right?
It is to the shit.
There's something kind of compelling about that and both terrifying about it because it's really, especially now with digitization, it's just like it's so disembodied, you know, and I'm so paranoid about losing information, so I've got so many hard drives, you know. But and now they're talking about the cloud. I can't even, because I'm just sort of like an old fashioned Donald Judd sculptor, you know. It's like, how do you deal with it? You know, so it's really like destabilizing, you know. But like, and you know, I mean, I know that Elizabeth Price, who I work with, you know, she always talks about editing, you know, on the timeline and just this infinite decision making that you can make. Again, it's another abyssal space.
She talks about the timeline as an archive in a way, and that you can pull things out in any
an
infinite amount of reconfigurations.
And it's
the archive is the
You know, I mean, it's like it drives you. It can. You know, there's no. It feels like there's no resistance. Anything, you know, and it's thrilling, you know, in a way. but really inhibiting. So you set arbitrary rules and sets of things, you know, and this, you know, like this is a different version than I showed last time, and you know, I mean, I don't know what that's going to do for, you know, I mean, collecting at the other end, you know, people who collect this stuff, not that anyone does, but you know, potentially what they do with it. I mean, I know when I sold digital files to museums, this is owned by Tate, and they just sent a man around on a courier around on a bike with a hard drive, and you just give him a QuickTime file. Like, what would Anthony Caro think? It's a sort of jokey way to talk about something quite serious, but it's quite destabilizing in a way, you know.
Well, it's so contrary to the potential of the medium to control it like that.
Yeah, I know. I know. Well, it's exactly. But that's there's that thing that, like, what I think Brian, I always end up quoting Brian Eno. I'm such a dad at the disco. Sorry. But he spoke about recorded music, and it's only like the history of recorded music is only about 100 years old. So, you know, I grew up with recorded music as a particular form, the record, the LP, you know. But that's before then, music was just made here and now, you know, it wasn't an artifact in that way, it was a different type of artifact. So, this recorded artifact in that way, and digitization has completely gone back almost to pre-artifact moment because of file sharing and SoundCloud, and you know, it's really liberated the medium again, you know, but through technology.
But then it's interesting on a sort of a commercial level how that actually changes how bands make money. So they make money through live performance.
Through live
performance,
not through record sales.
Recorded.
Yeah.
Makes
that
money through using it on adverts.
Yeah.
Licensing.
And artists who make moving image make money by teaching.
I mean, it is interesting though, like because that there's still a material problem with that about archiving moving image work.
It's a real thing.
Like, because your hard drive that the courier came around to pick up is going to start deteriorating in 25 years.
Yeah.
And actually, the most durable format is film in that respect. That's good for 100 years. Stored properly. But I mean, you know, the idea that it's just out there, it still has to be physically kind of present somewhere. So
embodied somewhere, somehow.
Yeah. And unless that's kind of taken care of, you know, it's still a huge issue, and actually it's become a much more pressing issue, actually, you know, in terms of the way things have gone digital, and even films gone digital.
Yep.
You know, like Carton's transferred from 16mm, it's digitized. But like in terms of archival storing it, you'd probably be better off sticking to 16mm.
Yeah.
But try getting that shown.
Difficult.
Yeah.
I'm sort of secretly thrilled that the work only has a certain life to it.
Yeah.
Anyway. It's like ideas, you know. They might only have a certain life.
But the
it doesn't have to be forever.
The thing that struck me with the photographs of the chairs,
the headrests.
Are they headrests?
They're headrests, so they're only all about this big.
Right.
They're so they're like pillows.
But because I remember reading a bit about it, but is it right to say that the actual, like, the kind of memory of these things have gone to an extent that there's no certainty about the actual purpose of, you know, were they ceremonial objects, were they kind of objects of utility?
Yeah, I'm not the person to speak to about that, but I'm sure that,
Sarah Worden, who we talked to.
Yeah, we did.
She was the ethnographic curator at the museum. did talk about that, and she said that it's very unclear how they started, although they do believe that they were used, and that at least some of them became ceremonial and carried on a life in that way.
Mm.
But then they are still being made as well, which is another thing that I find quite interesting, that they originated as a useful object, maybe departed into a ceremonial object, and now are made purely as
tourist objects,
collectible objects, and this almost the same objects are being reproduced right now.
Yeah.
For sale.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing of.
And that idea of what's a reproduction.
Well, what gets transferred from along the way. I mean, you know, it's. I do wonder where all this. Well, it's about money, isn't it? Basically, that's why we're so worried about preserving certain things rather than other things. It's about, well, not always. It's about social history as well, but a lot of it seems to be around money. You know, certain things have to be preserved in a certain way, and I'm kind of okay with things constantly mutating.
It's quite interesting as well, going back to sort of Judd and his. And Martha and that idea of permanent installation and some kind of desire for completeness, and then Robert Adams as well in terms of his relationship with not
classical
just designing
culture,
the space, designing all the objects and
within
how you would
space,
move in that space.
Yeah. What's that about?
I think
is it fear?
Trying to create a very specific, you know, that he's that word, a very specific object that I don't know if it's a Schopenhauer thing, you know, extricating yourself from the flow of will in the world or something, but you know, having a specific object and a moment where you come up against something that is not part of the flow, is not part of the digital flow or the or whatever, and
the human flow.
And causes a moment of surprise.
Yeah.
But also, you know, from what we're talking about, the fascination of objects and around objects and what we project upon objects and how objects become, I noticed the term sticky object, you know.
Yeah.
I think he was just trying to create a situation where you might encounter that and address it in the same way that you
That's
do. As a kind of, you come at it with a consciousness of the object, but also your relationship to the object, the meta levels, allowing those meta levels to exist for a moment.
That's interesting.
And he clearly felt that the conditions in everybody else's museums were not
right.
Sufficiently. Geared towards having that happen. He may also have been a megalomaniac.
There's a bit of, I think, take your pick. But I think that, I can see that. I can see that desire, you know. But I think, you know, I get that feeling from reading a bit of Wallace Stevens' poetry or something. You know, it's like the language is concrete, you know, the image, you know, it's like, you can get it from. You don't have to control a city, you know.
No, and of course, John's own language, similarly.
Yeah.
That terse.
Yeah.
You can see him doing it.
Yeah. I guess it's where you locate that materially, is what becomes the. And I try and locate that materially somewhere different.
It's interesting what you're saying there about sort of being apprehended through your bodily experience as well, and that in relation to all the objects in this exhibition being chairs, stools, headdress, I think, and noticing, you know, a part of the narrative in Louis Ghost Chair is about how you experience the objects physically in terms of how your clothes rub against you, and also rub against the space of the city.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking about that in relation to feeling, or your feeling.
Your feeling, yeah.
And in relation to that, those sort of architectural theories as well, in terms of, from what I understand, that film will move into the architectural space.
So, Ur Feeling is a phrase which comes from a conversation between the architect Peter Eisenman and Charles Jenks, who's a writer and sometimes architect. And Peter Eisenman talks about a kind of situation that you, like when you're walking through the street and you sense maybe the street plan is a bit kind of, you know, all the buildings are much closer together, and it's a bit narrow, and there may be modern buildings, but, you know, and you sort of sense, you sort of feel something, and as in primary or proto, and this is German, and as in you are feeling, as well as and also it's one of the first cosmopolitan cities, I think. So it's primary, it goes back to the proto idea. So say you're walking through the street, you sense something different about the space you're walking through, but you don't quite know what it is yet. And it's that moment of precognition that he's talking about. But a second later, you might recognise it as being like, oh, it's on a medieval street plan or something like that, and that's why everything's a bit closer together. But it's that sudden sensing of it before you actually turn it into language. It must be some kind of language, but you turn it into recognition, you know? It's that moment that he's talking about. He's talking about that. He thinks that's like a really sort of what architecture's all about in some way. It's like apprehending it through the body, you know? That's. I don't think the film's going to be about that. that's another whole other 2 hours to talk about what the film's going to be. That'll bore everyone.
Or maybe we should wait and see.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, rather than... maybe we should apprehend the film.
Bodily, at Camden.
Yeah.
In September.
Yeah. No, the film won't be ready for then, but the exhibition which will exist is the trailer. For the film will somehow exist.
Okay. I think unless anyone has anything they'd like.
Yeah.
Takes back to the discussion that's just been had about showing the photographs of the objects.
Yeah.
And I kind of wondered, did you ever consider showing the original Louis chair, the ghost chair, and your remade junt as objects as part of the exhibition?
Yes, we did.
At one point,
we were going to show Donald.
But you couldn't get permission.
No. But we didn't. I think we both felt that to show it in this instance, to show the judge in the same building as the film, was to, I wasn't trying to set that narrative up. Like, sometimes that you could see that in works when people do that, but I just didn't want to do that. It just didn't feel right. And there was the opportunity of showing somewhere else, and that didn't turn out. Because I couldn't control the setting adequately enough.
That idea of you as the artist controlling the gaze, and I really enjoy the film, and it's beautifully shot, it's a beautiful gaze, but it's not mine. And I was kind of curious about this idea of seeing the film and then comparing it to how I would look at the object in its presence.
Yeah, yeah. think that's an interesting one, actually. But I just, and I think that's a nice thing to do. Am I a control freak? Is that what you said? yes. No. That's the right answer.
Maybe.
Yes. No. maybe. Yeah. Yeah. In this instance, it didn't seem right. But I think it's something to think about and to work with, because that is a very controlling look. But that's what a camera does.
Yeah.
Even a quick camera, a quick edit does. It does. It can't not do, because it's an artifact. It's in the way of your view, you know. Well, anyway, that's my understanding of it.
I don't know. It's related. This is hard. But I'm just thinking about having seen the Jodd object in a show at Herald Street.
Oh yeah.
And obviously, and it makes total sense for them to be separated. I think it sort of becomes demonstrative or something unless you do that. But what I found so interesting about looking at that object itself, and I found it was completely removed when I saw it on film, was how problematic I find it as an object in Herald Street. Because, and I was thinking about it, it's because of how particular the choice of that Jodd sculpture is. Because if you'd chosen a sculpture made by Jodd a year before that, or well, be a painting at that point, or a sculpture made a year after, which would have been made by Bernstein Brothers, and
that's
was fabricated,
right.
You could have made it, remade it exactly. You chose pretty much the last one he made with his dad.
Yeah.
And it's got that weird tube in it, which he supposedly found on Canal Street or whatever, embedded in it. It's like this sort of ready-made that he made a red box for.
Yeah, which is weird again. Whole new narrative.
And I just thought it was really interesting that you chose to copy that one. It's almost deliberately the most problematic because, you know, he got into all these legal wranglings with Count Panza in the mid-70s because he basically bought these drawings that he thought would then be refabricatable, almost like what we're talking about. You were talking about SoundCloud and the idea of an MP3 or something.
Yeah.
But this, I just found it was, I found it certainly, just saying about the sort of my experience of the object, I find that really strange. But then the film, as you say, sort of makes it a sort of very different thing, but then it becomes a bridge between the two chairs.
Well, I mean, initially it was only ever going to be a prop. We were discussing distressing it. Maybe that's what we're doing here. But because we made it and look, we method acted making it, it sort of began to have a quality. And I thought, oh, this now becomes a piece of work, actually. But yes, I did choose it because I'm particularly interested in its awkwardness. And the way it sits in a room, and the way it almost looks a bit like, it's like that work from that period. It could almost have gone another way. It could have become another artist. It's Jodd before he was quite Jodd, and it's so the sense of potentiality, which we all like to talk about in art school, is really strong. You know, it has a really strong sense of potentiality about it, because it could have gone another way. And so it's sort of, it's almost like almost gone like Joseph Cornell or something.
Mm.
You know, it's another American narrative, you know, which is like, imagine that. That
would you be see, it's interesting what Neil says, and all that information about that particular object, which I didn't know.
Yeah.
And then
sorry, I'm quite nerdy about that.
I suppose if you know that, then the ghost chair and the precursors that actually, rather than him, his work being a mediator between them, they actually come to augment what that is. For me, they start then interpreting what that is in that little plastic log. Do you know what I mean? It seems more of a tool for that rather than the other way around.
Okay.
But that requires, you know, knowing about that object's awkwardness, which maybe if you have the object there, it's more apparent than it is if it's not. I'm not saying
No, I know.
Just changes your
I know, but this thing, you know, this opportunity in the future.
Mm-hmm.
It just didn't quite work out, did it?
Mm.
I like the idea of walking 10 minutes somewhere else to look at it in a different building.
Mm.
You know, and then you see a film here, and so you just can't. Is that, you know, there's that sort of Roni Horn piece where you can never see the same.
Mm.
It's in two parts, and you can only see one bit at one time, another bit at the other. So they're identical, they're machined in identical ways, but you have to walk from one room to the other, so you can never. You have to use your memory to see what the other half of the work is like. You know.
But then you do end the film with a quote about order, and I mean, then that whole order of experience and knowledge and does sort of condition how you read the film when you first see it. So maybe if I saw it now, you know, and you're seeing it after having seen Herald Street, so...
So what was the thing in Herald Street? Was it your reproduction?
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. I was in a group show at Herald Street, and I showed the Dharma Job. And
but was it in juxtaposition with the film?
No, in a room with some photographs by somebody else. So it was just a discrete object that had no reference to it being a film. I got asked to be in the show, and I was going to show something else, and I thought, oh, I like this thing instead. Can I show that? Because it seemed more exciting, because it was started off as a prop, and then I suddenly made an artwork. So I showed that. And so it was a kind of... it was done in that sort of way. So that's how you do exhibitions sometimes. They're just... You know, one exhibition talks to another exhibition you've just had, or you know, one you might have in the future, or you know.
But it is interesting that that quote about it's just order,
simple order,
simple order, does come after those works where
it
he's
does.
Starting to work in a more serial way.
It does. Yeah, Judd's idea of order is not like grand. French architect, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
It's not like that. It's more like one thing after another, just local order, you know, it's simple.
Order.
Well,
and the
simple.
Impossibility of that.
Well, he's using it instead of contingency. The kind of the 1950s generation used chance, but he didn't fit as a way of holding off other expectations around genius or, you know, whatever, to hold that.
Oh, right, okay.
It was also about hierarchy as well, because he saw hierarchy as being inherently European, and serialism was to do with this idea of this new productive American 1960s thing, so just...
Fordist.
Yeah, just, yeah, Fordist, basically, yeah.
And but neutral, you know,
a
premise, a way of using something that...
But the way he talks about it,
that's
it's like it's almost natural, like
because
like local order, almost like no order at all,
because it which you mentioned Poirot, so to avoid relation and to avoid composition, to avoid all of those things, to create trying to create something neutral,
which is at the risk of sounding too Derridean, order always opens onto the abyss.
Well, this is.
You mentioned this.
Yes, this is he effectively conjured what he abhorred, and he's supposedly using order, but he's using reflective materials like plexiglass, creates all sorts of
fantasy psychedelic moments.
Yeah.
I know it's and I sort of used that hopefully at directing you how to read the word.
Well, you're the artist, you should.
Well, no, in a way, I guess I was trying to use that to, I was colliding my own words with his words, you know, about order, about getting through the day, basically. That was my interpretation, you know, like, you need a simple order to get things done, like where you put your keys, or how you get from A to B. You know, that was my idea of order. And then I tried to collapse it with his.
Yeah.
that idea.
Anyone else wanted to? Well, thank you
very
much.
No, thank you. That was great.
We'll just stay around. The film will be on for another while if you want to watch it again, and drinks and so forth.
That would be good.